everyone, and welcome to episode 40 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. So it's our 40th episode, and for today's episode, I'm going to be answering some questions that people asked on social media. So it's a question and answer podcast today. I'm answering your questions as best I can. So the first question I'm going to go with is from Bruno Oliveira on YouTube, and he was asking, what was the postal system like during the Middle Ages? Because the Romans had a pretty sophisticated one. What is it like in the Middle Ages? Well, if you wanted to send a letter in the Middle Ages, it would have to be pretty important, because for most of the Middle Ages in Europe, people were using parchment, which means that they had to use animal skin to send their messages, which means that it had to be important enough to actually buy the parchment, write on it. If you were someone who was illiterate, you'd have to ask someone to write it for you, which meant you'd have to pay for their services to get someone to write it for you. So it would have to be something that was reasonably significant in order for you to send a message that was actually written down in the first place. And if you're going to do that, you need to send it via a person. When I think about the postal system in the Middle Ages, I think of it kind of like the Pony Express, which is something we had in North America, where you're sending a message and it can only go so far with one person on one horse, and then you have to rest the horse, right, and the person, and you need fresh horses. So if you were somebody who was rich or noble, you might have horses that were fresh horses in different cities, and then you could get your message across pretty fast, but it becomes more complicated. So if we're talking about the Roman system, the Roman Empire covered a huge amount of territory, and it all was under kind of the same umbrella. So you could have stations where you could have horses relaying messages, not relaying the messages, but relaying the messengers. And that's something you'd have during the Roman Empire. Whereas if you're trying to send a message from, you know, England to Spain, you might have to go through lots of different towns. It's not going to be a place where perhaps you have horses ready. So that means it's going to take longer. And so the postal system during the Middle Ages wasn't as efficient. I think for ordinary people, it would be much more efficient to send a person with a message and hope that they got there. And again, if it was really important, you'd have to send several copies of the message, because perhaps it might not get there through just one channel. One thing that they did use in the Middle Ages when they were trying to get messages out were carrier pigeons. So say if you're under siege and you need to get a message out, you definitely can't send a horse. You need to send something else, and you could send a carrier pigeon with a message. And they actually are really efficient and fast. The only trouble is the people who are besieging a castle usually saw that coming, and they had things like hawks and falcons and archers to take care of your message. So again, you'd want to have several copies of it. So in general, the postal system was not as efficient as it was in the Roman Empire. And that is simply because the countries that were covered by the Roman Empire were separate countries in the Middle Ages in Europe. So you'd have to have networks in which you could send something along from one messenger to another. Perhaps it'd be easier if you're sending it from one church to another. But if you're sending it across cultures, it's going to be more difficult. You'd have to hire someone else to pass the message along, or you'd have to wait for your horse and your messenger to rest. So in conclusion, not as efficient as the Roman system. So Oliver on Patreon asked, do I have a favorite knight? And yes, Oliver, I definitely have a favorite knight. And the more you poke around my work, the more you will see this coming up again and again. My favorite knight is Sir Gawain. He's awesome. He's awesome from the first time that you come across him in the Mabinogion. He's Arthur's nephew. And so he's one of the oldest knights in the Arthurian tradition. He's been there since the beginning, since an oral tradition. And you'll see in pretty much every story except for Malory's, Mort d'Arthur, he's the best knight. Chrétien de Troyes comes up with Lancelot a bit later. Lancelot is a written poem, so he comes across later than Gawain. And even in Lancelot's poem, I actually wrote this in an article called Five Ways Gawain Kicks Lancelot's Ass. In his own poem, his first poem, Lancelot just about falls out the window, for example, seeing Guinevere from afar. And it's Gawain that saves him. So Gawain is he's a wonderful, wonderful character. And my favorite romance is Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which I've talked about on other podcasts, so I'm not going to get into the plot too much. But it's really a sophisticated story about what you do when you have promised different things to different people. What's the right thing to do in that kind of a situation? So there's another story of Sir Gawain that I really, really love. It's one I came across early on in my learning about medieval romance, and it's called Sir Gawain and Dame Ragnall. And it's a story about, it's from the Loathly Lady tradition. And what happens in the story is King Arthur goes off into the forest and he gets captured by an evil knight named Sir Gromer Somerjour, which I just think is the best name ever. And of course, because it's a medieval romance, Sir Gromer Somerjour says, "Well, you're under my power, King Arthur. You have to come back in 1 year and tell me what women want. And if you can do that, then I will let you go." And so King Arthur, he's looking around. He can't figure it out. He's going around for a year trying to figure out what women want. Maybe men can relate to this. I don't know. Trying to figure out what women want. And he cannot figure it out. And so this woman, she's a horrible looking woman, meets up with King Arthur and says, "I will help you. I'll tell you what women want in exchange for letting me marry Sir Gawain." And Arthur's like, "Well, I'm kind of in trouble. I'll have to ask." So he asks Gawain, and Gawain says, "Of course, I'll do this for you, Arthur, no problem." And so Dame Ragnall tells Arthur what women really want is the ability to make their own decisions. Sovereignty, that's what they want. And so King Arthur tells Sir Gromer Somerjour what women want is sovereignty. And of course, you know, he's released. Dame Ragnall's sort of in trouble, but she gets to marry Sir Gawain, so everything is good. So they get married. And, you know, it comes to the wedding night and Gawain's like, she's something, this woman. I mean, she's gross. She's got all this snot coming from her nose and she's got basically got tusks. She's a horrible monster of a person. But Gawain knows what he has to do on his wedding night and he's getting ready and he looks up and Dame Ragnall has become a beautiful woman. And she says, "I can either be a beautiful woman at night when it's just the two of us, or I can be a beautiful woman during the day when you're out with your friends." So basically, Gawain has to choose whether he wants her to look beautiful in the bedroom or as her public face. And she says, "You have to decide, when do you want me to look beautiful?" And Gawain, spoiler alert, I'm going to tell you how this ends because this is why I love Gawain. So if you don't like spoilers, just skip the next 30 seconds. Are you ready? Gawain says, "I will let you choose." And with that, Gawain has broken the spell and Dame Ragnall is beautiful all the time. She's the perfect wife and they are perfectly happy together. And it's all because Gawain let her make the choice about how she wanted to present herself. And so, I mean, with that kind of a story, how could you choose Lancelot as your favorite knight? I don't know. Sir Gawain is my favorite knight. He's been my favorite knight forever. And he will continue to be my favorite knight. Okay, I'm going to take a stab at this name. I don't know how to pronounce it. I'm going to do my best. It looks like Hen Shin Banano on YouTube asks, "How did city planning work in the Middle Ages?" So this is the type of thing where you kind of have to make generalizations about a question like this, but it is different. Cities, we know they kind of grow organically where people are settling. One of the first things that you need when you are creating a city, of course, a settlement, is water. And so you'll find medieval cities, they're basically around water. And that's pretty common sense, really, because you need it for drinking, you need it for cleaning, you need it for watering your animals, you need it for things like laundry, as well as transportation and latrines, which we're going to get to later. So medieval cities, they're based around water pretty much all the time, whether they're ports or whether they're based on rivers. And they did plan their cities. We do know that. The things that they have in the center of a city, it's not usually a castle. It's usually a church or a market square. The streets kind of grow organically from there. And if you've been in a European city, you see it's pretty twisted. The roads are twisted. They're not laid out in kind of a North American grid. So in a way, it's kind of organic how cities grow. But how did cities get planned out? Well, all the land was owned by the king, and he would allow you to have a certain amount of land. If you were a noble, then you had land you could do with what you want, and he could redistribute it at will. So many of the towns would have charters, and the charters would establish things like what you could do within the town, what kind of tolls would be levied for all sorts of things, like what you were selling there. Charters also established things like what was allowed to be traded there, who could trade things, what the rules were generally going to be. And within those towns, you had elected officials that would be making decisions about stuff like, we need to have a ditch here, or we need to improve the way that we drain our streets, for example. So these things are kind of decided through charters, but they definitely had the input of elected officials within the towns. So charters would establish things like the geographical limits of the city, what people could do within the city, and what they could do to the city. So these were established by charters, and again, also by elected officials within the town itself. So it's sort of pseudo-democratic, but not really. You still had to have the permission of the king to really change a lot of things within the city. So the second question that was asked was, what kind of tools did people use to build their cities? Well, this is kind of a simple answer in that they used many of the same tools that we use today. And that is, they used things like hammers and axes and drills and chisels and tools made out of stone and iron and steel. And they built mostly wooden buildings, sometimes like wattle and daub buildings within the town. But they knew that these type of buildings were really, really susceptible to fire. So you'll see, especially in places like the Netherlands, there are ordinances saying you should change your cities from wood buildings to stone building. And this is to reduce the risk of fire. You can see medieval building techniques if you check out the castle of Guédelon, which is being built in France. One of my favorite things that people are using to build Guédelon, and also were using back in the Middle Ages, were cranes, medieval cranes. Because, you know, if you look at a cathedral, scaffolding will only go so high. You can only carry so much stuff up by yourself. So, of course, they use ladders and pulleys and all that stuff. But medieval cranes use sort of a human hamster wheel, where people would be walking along this wheel, and that would be pulling stuff up really, really high to the top of a cathedral or another such building. So when I think about what tools people were using to build these cities, I'm thinking about these amazing medieval cranes. So CP Ennin on Twitter asks the question that I always get asked as a medievalist, and that is, how did people deal with human waste? That is a really good question. That is, if not the most common question that I get, it's certainly one of them. And the answer to that is, in a much more sanitary fashion than we imagine. So how do they deal with human waste? And the question actually that CP Ennin is asking is how common people dealt with it. So if we look at a castle, people had built garderobes, which were kind of like ensuite bathrooms, off of their bedrooms usually, sometimes off of the great hall. And those were just little closets that had a hole on a bench, and the waste would empty, usually outside the walls of the castle, so that it didn't build up on the inside of the castle. This could be an issue sometimes, because any hole on the outside of a castle is a vulnerability. It was Chateau Gaillard in France that was infiltrated through the hole in a garderobe. So it's useful to have those. I've even seen two-seater ones in Scotland, which are very, very cool. So that's what people in castles used. What did the common people use? Well, they used privies or latrines, just like you would if you were camping today. So you would have kind of an outhouse outside of, well, your house, where you could go to the washroom, get all your business done. And we know that they use these outdoor latrines because there are laws and guidelines for things like how far you should keep it away from your well you know, they were thinking about things like you don't want to actually have any seepage from your outhouse getting into the water supply. And this is because if we're talking about cities, people are living pretty close together. So you do have to think about these things. So a privy that you'd have in the Middle Ages, it would be in your yard, possibly in your cellar. Sometimes you would have a garderobe in your house and you'd have a pipe going down to a latrine. And hopefully you'd have your backyard privy lined in stone, at least the pit lined in stone. And that's because, you don't want seepage into your water supply. That's just a horrible thing. It's not what people wanted. You could line it with wood. That was easier. It was cheaper. And so a lot of people did that. A lot of people also cut corners by just sinking a wine barrel, a big wooden wine barrel called a tun, into their backyard and using that. Now, the thing is with this kind of latrine is it will get full and you'll have to empty it if you want to keep using it. And so you'd have to hire the services of somebody who did this as a profession. That person was called the gong farmer in English. And these people were well paid because they would be cleaning out your latrine and carting away the stuff that was in it. And they would get paid by the ton. T-U-N, by the big barrel that they emptied. And you did have to pay for it. You know, you can find a lot of this stuff in the really great book called Urban Bodies by Carol Rawcliffe. I've talked about this book before, but it's got a whole section on latrines. And it'll tell you that sometimes people try to delay calling the gong farmer and they got in big trouble because nobody wants that stuff around. Now, if you were out and about in a city, a big city, one like London, you could find a public bathroom. There were public bathrooms all over the place. Sometimes these were paid for through money left behind by people who had died. They'd left some money in their will to build a public bathroom because it's important to have them around. So there were places to go to the bathroom. You didn't have to do it in the street. In fact, if you did it in the street, people would give you trouble for it. So in cities, you could have your own backyard privy, or you could go to a public one, or you could share one with a neighbor. So there were options for that. Many times these, if they didn't empty into a pit in your yard, they would empty into the river, although that started to kind of go by the wayside because it was pretty gross and it was making trouble for people. Or sometimes people just created a garderobe in their house and stuck a pipe heading to the outside into the alley, which is pretty gross. Once people found out that they were emptying into the alley, they got in trouble. So is it as sanitary as now? Certainly not. But it was something that people considered more carefully than we might imagine. People were not just, you know, emptying out in the streets because that is not something that anybody appreciated. So that is how people got rid of human waste in the Middle Ages. It got taken out by the gong farmer in a ton, taken outside the city limits. So again, I'm going to take my best stab at this. Another question by Yara Delange on Twitter is about monastic prisons. So the question is, why did some abbeys conceal the presence of prisons? And this is kind of a really difficult question to answer because, I mean, it depends. It depends on a whole bunch of things. So were people sometimes held in an abbey or a monastery as a prison? Yep. But I would have to look at an individual case of why of it being concealed, that people were being kept there to be able to answer why someone might do that. Sometimes you would have somebody that was kept apart at a convent or a monastery, a political prisoner. Maybe they didn't want other people to know that that person was there. So that could be one reason. But I would have to look at an individual case in order to answer the question why it was concealed. Probably for political reasons, I would think, but get back to me on a case that you'd like to look at. But the second part of the question was, could people in a monastery, for example, legitimize torture and imprisonment for people who were being punished? Well, yes. Could they justify it? Could they legitimize it? Yeah, but under certain circumstances, right? So if you listen to the podcast with Larissa Tracy that was specifically dealing with torture and punishment, you'll know that torture and punishment are two separate things. They often get conflated when people talk about the Middle Ages, that people were kind of trigger happy when it came to things like torture and punishment. But in the Middle Ages, these are two separate things. Torture was used to get a confession out of people so that they could be prosecuted by the law. So torture was a means to an end, and that end was justice. Punishment, it's a consequence. So punishment is something different. So there were rules, specific rules around torture and punishment, which I think are better explained by Larissa Tracy in that podcast episode. When it comes to monasteries and convents, they often follow the rule of Saint Benedict. And the rule of Saint Benedict does advocate for a corporal punishment. So that was a possibility. Sometimes he leaves it open, like the example of people who interrupt everyone's Sunday reading. Saint Benedict basically says, make an example of somebody who keeps interrupting everybody's reading so that nobody does it again. This isn't licensed to be a sadist, but corporal punishment was a thing, even in a monastic context, yes. But again, it was all kind of based on context. People didn't just torture each other for fun in the Middle Ages. It was a very specific context. And again, I'd refer you back to Larissa Tracy's great work, whether it's on the podcast or other work that she's done. Vanessa Sejo on Twitter asks, what are some of the best research books for daily life? Vanessa, I'm so glad you asked, because one of them is my own that I've just come out with, Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction. It depends on what you're looking for. So if you're talking about baby steps, my book is a good place to start, because I do talk about all sorts of different aspects of the Middle Ages, from food to things like torture and punishment, law and justice, religious life, sexuality, all those things they're in there. So that's a good spot to start. Again, a really friendly place to start are those books by Joseph and Francis Guise. So there's Life in a Medieval City, there's Life in a Medieval Castle. Those books are, again, a good place to start. As a book for people who are kind of one step further, I would say definitely, we've just talked about it, Urban Bodies by Carol Rawcliffe is something that again covers a huge amount of stuff about life in medieval cities. And again, Medieval Life, which is a book on archaeology by Roberta Gilchrist, it's thick, it's dense, but if you're at that point where you're past kind of the common questions, I would recommend that one as well. Vanessa also asked about people of color. So how racially varied was Europe? And I'm really glad you asked that question, because that's something that comes up again and again. There is this idea that Europe is this kind of place filled with white people, this Aryan race type stereotype. It's definitely not true. Were there a lot of people with light colored skin in Europe at the time? Yes, definitely. Was it racially diverse? Yes, definitely racially diverse. And I'm talking about race in our modern terms. So in the modern era, we tend to talk about race in terms of the color of people's skin, or perhaps their facial features or that kind of thing, physical markers of what we call race. In the Middle Ages, that differentiation was not done so much by how people looked, but their culture. So you might have somebody that had light skin, somebody that had dark skin, but they were thought of as being similar because they were both Christians, for example. So religion and culture were the markers of difference in the Middle Ages more than skin color was at the time. Now, it's complex, and I would direct you towards the series of articles on race at the Public Medievalist website. That's a great series, and it will answer all sorts of your questions. But were the people of color in medieval Europe? Absolutely, absolutely, all over the place. And you'll see this if you look at skeletal examinations. So for example, there is an article on medievalist.net that looks at the plague burial pits in London. 70% of those people are what we might call, at the moment, we might call Caucasian. So if 70% of the people in the grave are Caucasian, that means 30% of the people in the grave are not. So London is one city that was definitely very diverse, because it is a city that had ports in it. And so the port cities of Europe were really, really diverse in that there was constant trade all the time. All of the intermixing of peoples that happened during the Roman period through trade and through slavery, that stuff, those people were all still around. So with the invasions from the east, there were different peoples mixing as well. The slave trade continued into the Middle Ages. The Vikings were raiding not just for things, but for people. They were selling slaves into Russia, down to Africa. They were selling slaves everywhere. And so you'll find coins from the Middle East, for example, in the northern parts of Europe. These coins show that trade was happening across huge geographical distances, and some of that was slaves. And again, Peter Frankopan's Silk Roads will tell you about the slave trade and how people mixed and intermingled through that as well. When we're talking about medieval Europe, again, people kind of picture England and northern France. But the Mediterranean is definitely part of medieval Europe. And again, those port cities, definitely full of people from all over the place. Trade happening as far away as Greenland, India, China, Africa, all over the world. So there is definitely a mixture of people. But even if we look at northern France in England, It's not a whole sea of white people there. And a really interesting story is the story of Louis IX. He went on crusade, and when he was there, a whole bunch of people converted to Christianity for many reasons. And Louis decided he would take them home. He took them to the northern part of France, which was a safe place to take them because he didn't really want them too close to Spain, which was still Muslim territory. And the person who has traced this information and really brought it to the forefront is William Chester Jordan. So you can follow his work on Louis IX and the converts that he brought from the Middle East and kind of scattered around. These are hundreds of people scattered around northern France in order to integrate them into Christian life in France. So even in rural France, you'll see people who didn't look like kind of that stereotypical white looking person that you see in a lot of kind of negative propaganda about the Middle Ages. Again, if you want to learn more about trade routes, you can listen to the very first episode of the Medieval Podcast, which had Kathleen Kennedy talking about coconuts and how they were traded all over. So thank you for that question, Vanessa. Really important question. How diverse was medieval Europe? It was very diverse. So a question from what looks like Zutilo on Twitter asks, what was the criminal justice system like in post-Norman England? So the Norman Conquest, 1066, what was criminal justice like afterwards? The justice system at that time was based on things like trial by ordeal and trial by combat. Combat is pretty straightforward. If you had somebody who was accusing somebody else, they'd have to fight it out. And whoever won, God was on their side. So they were telling the truth, whatever that truth was. It's really interesting. This is in my book as well. It's really interesting in that it was kind of, the waters were kind of muddied in trial by combat as well, because you could get someone to be your champion for you, right? If you couldn't fight yourself, you get a champion. And sometimes this would even be part of a plea deal. Someone would say, well, if you can get me off on these charges, I will be the champion in this person's place. And so it wasn't as straightforward as it was meant to be. Same with trial by ordeal. Ordeals would be things like being tossed into water that had been blessed as holy water. So if you were accepted by the water, that means you were innocent. You might still drown. If you were rejected by the water, that means you're guilty. So ordeals could also be things like being burned or having to reach for a stone at the bottom of a pot of boiling holy water. And if your burn healed cleanly, you were innocent. If it did not heal cleanly, then you were guilty. It's pretty obvious to us, just like it was pretty obvious to the people in the Middle Ages, that these things can be faked and they can be influenced by outside forces. And so even at the time of 1066, people were uncomfortable with trial by ordeal, trial by combat. They were using it because it seemed like it could be a sign of divine favor, perhaps, but people were uncomfortable with it. by the time 1215 came around, the Fourth Lateran Council, priests were not permitted to be a part of that at all. So they couldn't bless any holy water as part of ordeals, for example, because everyone agreed that this wasn't a good system. So between 1066 and 1215, what happened? Well, in England, it was Henry II that really kind of made some judiciary reform. So Henry II really pushed to make the laws, and again, these are the royal laws, not the church laws. He wanted the royal laws, secular laws, to be the same everywhere. And it's Henry that really had a lot to do with making sure that judges went around to different districts, made sure that they were hearing cases on behalf of the king. He really pushed for a trial system that that had juries making decisions. And so when Magna Carta became a thing under his son's rule, John's rule, this stuff had already been established. This is where you see trial by you're tried by a group of your peers. It really evolved over time, over a couple hundred years, from being trial by ordeal, from being trial by combat, to being a trial by jury with itinerant judges going around. On Patreon, Goral Sandstrom asks, what do we know about horsemanship in the Middle Ages? We actually know a fair amount about horsemanship in the Middle Ages because people like to write helpful books and they like to tell you about, you know, how to be a good falconer and how to be a good horseman and how to be a good person. These helpful books were a thing in the Middle Ages just as they are now. And one that I thought I would talk about is one that you can find on medievalist.net and kind of look at again more closely. It's about the Book of Horsemanship, which is written by Duarte the First of Portugal in the 15th century. And he talks about why you should learn how to ride and how you learn how to ride and the things that you can do on horseback that are important, like how to joust and how to fight and how to look really cool when you're on horseback. Meaning, you know, if you don't know how to ride very well, you can do these things like adjust your hood to make it look like you actually know what you're doing, which is kind of great as well. So we know about horsemanship in terms of how people used their horses. People talked about their horses, how to train them, how to use them, how to fight on horseback. And they have instructional manuals as well. So I would direct you and will direct you in the show notes to the Book of Horsemanship by Duarte, the First of Portugal. And you can check that out. And finally, if I come back around to Oliver on Patreon, he had a second question, a third question actually, because he asked me about my favorite knight and favorite Arthurian story. But he asked about seamstresses. And I think this is an important question that I want to come back to. So seamstresses, when people were sewing in the Middle Ages, they were mainly doing this at home for their own use. So the women were sewing stuff to be used by their own family, things like garments, towels, bedclothes, that kind of thing. And even in royal households, you had the women that were working on that kind of stuff. So they would be creating shirts or hose or that kind of thing. They'd be sewing it themselves for their own use. And in royal houses, they would also be embroidering stuff for the church too. That being said, there were also people who were doing things like sewing and embroidering professionally. If you were a woman, you could take in some sewing work as sort of piecework and you could make a living that way, especially if you were a widow and you didn't have another way to make a living. You could do something like laundry. Laundresses had a bad reputation. Taking in piecework of sewing was a better idea. We know that many times guilds would require their masters to be men. So you might easily have a tailor who was a man, and in the workshop, the people who would be working with him would be women. But often they weren't masters. That's not always the case, though. Medieval Towns, a reader by Marian Koleski, has information about guilds in Paris that were taking in masters that were both male and female, and one of them is the Embroiderers Guild. And I'll just read this part to you because I think, well, it'll tell you everything you need to know. It says, first, it is ordered that whoever wishes to be an embroiderer in Paris, male or female, may do so. provided he knows how to practice the craft of embroiderer according to the following usages and customs of the craft. And then it goes on to say things like, hey, make sure you know what you're doing. Don't take on an apprentice if you have one already. Things like, don't embroider at night because your stuff isn't going to be as good as if you do it in the daytime. And if we find out you're doing it at night, you'll be in trouble. You'll be fine. Things like that. So the life of seamstresses, well, it is enormously varied, right? So seamstresses could be the people who are working at home for their own families. They could be people who are working in the back of a shop for a master who was a man. They could be women who were masters in a guild as well. And they could be women who were just taking in piecework in order to pay the bills. So seamstresses, they had all sorts of experiences, and it's really kind of hard to sum it up as one, but those are some of the ways that you could be a seamstress in the Middle Ages. I want to thank everyone for your questions that you're sending in on social media. I'm always happy to answer questions whenever I can, and it's kind of nice to do it as our 40th episode, so thank you for sending those in. Before we go, here's Peter from Medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's new, Peter?
Hi, Danielle. Well, the big news from last week was this study that was done on ancient Rome, the genetic diversity. It actually goes all the way into the early Middle Ages, the study. And shockingly, it's Rome was a very diverse place with people coming from Africa and Asia and all parts of Europe that were in Rome for centuries.
Are we really shocked by that, though?
No, we're not.
Okay. Just checking.
Yeah. So we have the news about that on the site. Plus, we have a couple of pieces that we might have fun with. One is called Jesus Shopkeeper. So we're taking a look at female mystics and their experience of Jesus Christ. And we also have a quiz on the 13th century for you to try. So 13 questions about the 13th century. So please, all of you, I make them really tough. So try them out.
Can you get all 13 answers right?
Of course. I know all about everything.
That's what I thought. Okay, thanks, Peter.
You're welcome. Bye.
A couple of the people who are sending in questions are patrons on Patreon, and we are so grateful for our patrons. If you want to be involved and help to fund this podcast and my research and getting this podcast out to you every week, I would be most appreciative. And you can find our information out on our Patreon page, which is patreon.com/medievalists. And there you can find all sorts of stuff, like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare magazine, either on paper or digital subscriptions. You can also be part of our book club, and you can get to our $3 level where you can access the desktop version of medievalist.net without any ads. And really, what more could someone ask for? I mentioned when I was going through answering some questions that my book, Life in Medieval Europe, is out now in the UK. It came out on September 30th. So if you live in the UK, you can order that now. People in other parts of Europe are ordering it as well. North Americans, you can pre-order, and pre-ordering is actually a fabulous thing to do for an author because it makes my book look even better. You can pre-order your book from your favorite independent bookstore or from Amazon, or you can even order it from Pen and Sword Press. Thank you to all of you who have done so. I really, really appreciate it from the bottom of my heart. Thank you very much. As always, you can follow medievalists.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists, and you can follow me, Danielle Sobalski, all over social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks, everybody, for sending me your questions. I hope you have an amazing day.